Next, I spoke to Ceci Alfonso at her home in part one of a two-part discussion. She is a pioneer who worked on consulting with defendants who've been charged with a capital offense. In 1986, she consulted in over 1,000 capital cases working with bilingual Spanish-speaking persons in Cuba, Colombia, El Salvador, and Puerto Rico. In 1987, she wrote one of the first articles on the role of the social worker in the death penalty case. Her work is being archived at Harvard University. So I'm here in the home of a very special woman. I love your home environment. It's so peaceful and so quiet. Tell my listeners a little bit about you. First, tell them your name and a little bit about the extraordinary work that you've done over the years.
My formal name is Cecilia, but everyone knows me as Ceci. My last name is Alfonso. I was born and raised in New York City in Harlem. I'm Afro-Caribbean. My mother was Puerto Rican and my father was an Afro-Cuban. So I, basically come from very good stock. grew up at a time when the goal was to get out of Harlem and have a different life. Now we can't afford to go back into Harlem.
Right. So Harlem's an expensive place now.
Absolutely. So I went to nursing school and left there and finished that. I became a nurse and worked for about 5 years doing that. And then left, went to undergraduate school and in Rutgers in New Jersey. And I have a master's degree in social work, and I'm licensed in New Jersey and in New York. I think what I'd like to share is the work that worked at humanizing that individual that was charged with a criminal offense by our government, essentially, and how, my philosophy was if you're going to lynch using the means of, electrocuting someone or other means of the death penalty by injection, it's a human being. And I found an opportunity to take on the struggle by developing a practice. Let me start by saying that in 1988, 89, I was asked by an attorney to assist him in developing his client's life history. And I knew at that moment that being a social worker and being a woman of color and understanding on some level what the criminal justice system was doing to my community, which had been done in the past, because one cannot deny that the criminal justice system is the 20th and 21st century form of prosecution and oppression.
So for my listeners, I mean, you've been very modest about talking about your experience, but for my listeners, I really want to say that it's my understanding that you were a pioneer in the field of evaluating and taking histories on men, mostly, who are on death row and humanizing their stories and giving the legal system a view of their life.
Correct. When I say I'm a pioneer, is, and I was, and I continue, I think, to to struggle against, like I said, a system that in lots of ways is very oppressive. But what in 1988, what I found was when this attorney asked me to assist him, I found a system in which the lawyers, the whole criminal justice system that was supposed to be defending these individuals, did not have the tools, the skill set, or the understanding of the community that they were going to have to present to the jurors. Mm-hmm. And so clearly I saw an opportunity in which I could tell the story of my client and his and her life, and more importantly, how that person got there. If you look at it and say, well, there are thousands of people who are oppressed, yet they don't commit crimes. So why was it that this particular individual is charged with committing a crime where the federal government feels or the state feels that an appropriate punishment would be death? But what I found was that those who were mandated to defend and protect these individuals did not have the skills, did not know how to articulate the kinds of assaults on human beings that would lead them to commit a particular crime. And I'll give you an example of, I remember I had a case in Baltimore, and the well-intended attorney went into a public housing and came back out, and I was scheduled to meet with him. And when I did, he said, you know, I knocked on the door and asked the lady if I could speak to her, the mother of the client, and I got no information. And I said, oh, just stay right here. I'll be right back. And I went and spoke to the mother and was able to begin the process of developing the trust and developing the relationship that was needed in order for her to help me see what were the issues, the dynamics, the limitations, the failures, and the hopes of this family that could explain how this individual could have committed this kind of crime. And as a result, I also found that I had no choice but to try to educate the legal system as to how to approach our community. From simple things like reaching out to the community of color because you believe that you want to defend them, you want to fight for their rights, you want to protect them, particularly when the state wants to kill them, then how about reflecting a connection to those people by simply having magazines in the office that represent the people you serve? I have to say that that was received as a brilliant idea.
So what you're saying is you told the attorneys, listen, if you want to connect to your clients when they come to your office, maybe have an issue of Ebony or some Latino magazine in the lobby so they can read that while they're waiting, because that will help them feel comfortable and connect with you without you even saying a word.
Exactly. Because for many of our clients, the class difference, it's the leap is enormous. And so for many family members, it was extremely difficult. It was very high anxiety for them to come from a very poor rural community, because my cases that I had were all over the country. So I would find myself working with an individual who was charged with a capital offense in a rural community, and working in, you know, Missouri, and then working in New Jersey.
So tell me some of the states that you visited. Where did you see these men? I'm assuming most of them were men.
Yes. 95% of my clients in my 30-year career has been men. Some have been white men, but the majority of my clients have been African American and Latino. Mm-hmm. Many of them were troubled and hurt at a very young age, and to articulate that and express that to 12 people who may not have any idea how this individual's life was, what they know, you have to realize that most juries in this country are made up of people who are different from their clients in terms of race, in terms of class, even gender. And so trying to explain to these 12 people, how could something like this happen? How could someone commit such a crime? Required that I testify, that I share that information. Mm-hmm. I remember having a case in which I had to explain what were the emotional and physical assaults on this client that made him bitter and angry and narrow in his focus. And so I had to explain that although the parent was responsible to the jurors, I stressed that the parent was responsible, but they were not nurturing. They were the kind of parent who would meet their obligations in terms of taking care of their child, but saying, I love you, you're a wonderful kid, was not something that he received. And that was very damaging.
Would you say that that was a theme that was repeated from person to person over your 30 years of assessing men who are on death row?
The dynamics, they're not necessarily on death row, because I work on capital cases when the individual was indicted. So in 1988, we went from in 1988, learning what the mitigation specialist, the clinical social worker's role was. And in that process, we've gone from standardizing it, making it much more a profession, a field where...
So would it be fair to say then that your work was primarily working with men who'd been indicted for a capital crime?
Correct.
And their attorneys were looking for a way to convince the jury that they did not need to be executed.
Right. The task of the attorney was to communicate and convince, really persuade the jury that the punishment, the appropriate punishment for the particular crime in which they have already found this person guilty of, mm-hmm. is life imprisonment or life with parole or not even life. Less than life, mm-hmm. In prison. And so in order to do that, they had to tell the client's story, humanize that client. Mm-hmm. The client is not just the crime that you've heard about, that you've convicted this individual of. There's more to this person, and let me tell you about this person. Mm-hmm. Through me, through my voice, through my investigation, through my educating the jurors to very subtle things. For example, attorneys and jurors needed to know in one particular case, the issue was shade.
Shade,
tone, skin color. In a household in which, in a society in which race, skin color, and tone is valued, its value is determined by how light it is. If you're in a household, and in one case, my client was the darkest and was treated. This is an African-American family, and because he was the darkest, he was rejected, he was ridiculed, he was alienated, and that resulted in an individual who did not feel safe in the world, did not feel valued, cared about. And my task was to not only explain that to the jury, but also educate the attorneys as to how the dynamics of race and color get played out in many homes and many families, and how to communicate that, how to articulate that. In another case, I had, and again, this is a young man who was, and another example in terms of race, this is a young man who was very privileged, who lived in a wealthy community, yet would prefer and was accused of committing a crime in one of the poorest, the impoverished communities. When he was arrested, he was found in a barren apartment with no furniture and essentially very filthy. Yet he, 20 blocks away, could have gone to live in his mother's $650,000 apartment. Why? Why would somebody do this and end up being accused of a crime? The way it took me a while, because I had to engage the family and I had to see the dynamics that were operating as opposed to just asking about what was going on. And what I found in terms of race was that this was an individual whose parents, particularly the mother, was very bigoted and would humiliate this child because of his darker skin and darker tone. Yet his siblings were of lighter skin, and they were treated marvelously and rewarded for their achievements.
So if you're just tuning in, you're listening to my me interviewing Cecilia, also known as Ceci Alfonso, a 30-year specialist in the area of working with men who've been accused of a capital crime, who need to have their story told to the jurors so that they won't be put to death.
Exactly.
So for my listeners, I just want to be clear. These men are guilty of the offense that they've been charged. The juror, the court system has declared that they are guilty.
The proceedings are, an individual is charged with a capital offense. The attorney defends the individual. The prosecutor must prosecute. The process of selecting 12 people who are going to make a decision of guilt or innocence is a long, sometimes short, but it is a process. It's not just, 12 people come in, we'll pick you. They have to be able and willing to consider, if they determine that it was appropriate, the death penalty. And once that's determined, then the jury will hear the facts of the case, of the crime, of what that individual is charged with, the circumstances that can lead them to conclude or not conclude that this individual committed this crime. Those 12 people will come back, will leave, and determine, let's just say that they determine that this individual committed the crime. They find him guilty. That is settled. Now is what's the appropriate punishment? And that proceeding is my area of expertise.
Mm-hmm. So for my listeners, if they wanted to reach out to you, if for some unfortunate person who may have a family member that's waiting and they need help, they need someone to present their family member's case, how can they reach you? What's a contact number, a Facebook, a website? How can someone reach out to you?
Well, I can be emailed, and that is Cessie, CESSIEALF, Cessie Alf, 123@gmail.com. And my telephone number is 518-928-8199.
Cessie, thank you so much for joining me on 105.3 FM, The Sanctuary.
Thank you.
That was part one of my discussion with Cessie Alfonso, talking about her work, her groundbreaking work, helping defendants charged with a capital crime avoid the death penalty. If you are just tuning in, you're listening to Hudson Mohawk Magazine on 105.3 FM in Troy, New York. To learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org. You can also follow us and like us on Facebook at facebook.com/mediasanctuary and on Instagram at Twitter at Media Sanctuary. If you have comments, suggestions, or a sour bone to pick, or kind regards, you can text us at 518-888-3004. Also, be sure to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, a wonderful celebration of all that is creative, which is up next.